This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
In Cameroon, an investigation is underway into the cause of an overnight fire that destroyed much of the country's parliament.
That's Smokey Edwin Kinzico reporting. We'll have the full story on this coming up. Also, Robert Mugabe, the longtime president of Zimbabwe, made his first public appearance today since the military placed him under arrest earlier this week. Foreign ministers from across Africa are in Washington today to discuss trade, security, and governance with U.S. officials. And the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says the South Sudanese government is engaged in a brutal, protracted military campaign. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has called for a quick return to civilian rule in Zimbabwe today. Earlier in the day, Robert Mugabe, the longtime president of Zimbabwe, made his first public appearance since the military placed him under house arrest earlier this week. Mugabe arrived at Zimbabwe's Open University on the outskirts of Harare to preside over a student graduation ceremony. The Zimbabwe Defense Force did release several photos of Mugabe yesterday, and a broadcaster read a statement from the military that said the ZDF said they are currently engaging the commander-in-chief, President Mugabe, on the way forward and will advise the nation of the outcome as soon as possible. Grace Mugabe was believed to be in line to succeed her husband before the military intervention. Mugabe's wife, Grace, was last seen just over a week ago at a rally with her husband. Her exact whereabouts are unclear. Amid the crisis in Zimbabwe's capital, there is also a flurry of activity in neighboring South Africa. The nation is home to a large Zimbabwean diaspora, and in recent weeks, prominent figures who supported the military takeover have cycled through the country. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa is revealing itself to be a possible staging ground for what happens next in Zimbabwe. That much has become clear in recent weeks as a revolving roster of big Zimbabwean names have circulated through South Africa. Those include the man poised to be President Robert Mugabe's successor, Mugabe's main political opponent, the powerful head of the War Veterans Association, and several other outspoken Mugabe opponents. President Jacob Zuma also serves as chairman of the Southern African Development Community, which on Sunday will hold an extraordinary summit on Zimbabwe in Botswana's capital. But Zimbabwe opposition politician Dumisa Dabengwa, a former intelligence chief who, he said, happened to be in South Africa this week as the military sent tanks rolling down the streets of Harare, took over national television, and put President Mugabe under house arrest, says outsiders have failed Zimbabwe and need to stay out. He says regional powers were too permissive in the wake of Zimbabwe's flawed, violence-marred 2008 elections.
The role of SADC after that, after setting up a roadmap for Zimbabwe, and failing to supervise and enforce the implementation of that roadmap is what has led to all this in Zimbabwe.
Like many members of Zimbabwe's opposition, he says the military's actions do not constitute a coup, but rather a correction to prevent Mugabe from anointing his unpopular wife as his successor at a ruling party conference in December. SADC and the African Union take a hard line on coups in member countries, suspending membership and imposing sanctions. Mugabe's actions earlier this month provided the spark for this flame as he fired his vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. That was widely seen as a step toward the installation of Mugabe's wife, Grace, as vice president and next in line behind her 93-year-old husband. Dabengwa, who heads the opposition ZAPU party, says Mugabe is now trying to exploit the regional body to remain in power. In recent days, he has been clearly resisting pressure from military officials and negotiators to quietly step down.
He wants to drag his feet. He wants to get SADC to leave things as they are, go to his ZANU-PF Congress, where his wife becomes elected as a vice president.
Dabengwa, who said he has heard his name mentioned as a possible member of a post-Mugabe transitional government, did not say what might happen if Mugabe gets his way. South Africa's government has long tried to distance itself from the appearance of interfering in its neighbors' affairs. Unlike other leaders in the region, no South African president has ever publicly called on Mugabe to step down. Solomon Socks Chikawero of the Global Zimbabwe Forum in Johannesburg says many Zimbabweans would have liked South Africa to be more outspoken before things escalated to this point.
It's not that South Africa is afraid of Mugabe per se, but they've got their businesses they protect in Zimbabwe, because once they say they talk bad about him, he will kick them out, because he's the one person who says, when he says, I'm going to kick you out, he will kick you out.
Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe since it gained independence in 1980, has become famous for sharp words like these. And he has made it clear that he sees only one path to leaving the presidency, saying last year, as long as I am alive, I will head the country. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. Meantime, some key figures in Zimbabwe's opposition are proposing a transitional government ahead of the elections already planned for next year. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai is urging Mugabe to resign. And for more on this, we have joining us today Blessing Zulu in the studio from VOA's Zimbabwe service. Thank you for joining us, Blessing.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
Well, Blessing, what are opposition figures saying about a possible transition, including talk of a potential government of national unity?
Yeah, what I'm gathering from my sources is that talks have actually begun between members of the ruling party that are opposed to President Robert Mugabe but support ousted Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa and the opposition MDCT that is led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. So they've started talks, the aim being to put pressure on Mr. Mugabe to step down by moving a motion in Parliament to impeach him. They think that they have the numbers. So even if SADC were to say the military must take the country back to the constitution, they are planning, this is option B of impeaching Mr. Mugabe. And there are also other processes that the ruling party has started. Provinces, they have about 10 provinces. So starting from today, the provinces, at least the majority that support Vice President or former Vice President Mnangagwa, are saying they've also started a motion to recall President Robert Mugabe. So they are pushing from all sides to ensure that he steps down and then they can form a transitional government or a government of national unity.
What will be the basis for the impeachment?
The impeachment, what they are saying is that Mr. Mugabe obviously has failed in his mandate as the president. Remember, the army was saying that there are many cases of corruption that Mr. Mugabe has not investigated, or at least when the police have stepped in to arrest some ministers. His wife, Mrs. Grace Mugabe, has moved to order the courts not to prosecute some people. So it's centered around the issue of Mr. Mugabe acting unconstitutional.
And she's taking a very low-key position at this time. Do you know of her location?
My sources are telling me that she's still in Zimbabwe, though BBC had earlier reported that she was in Namibia. We checked with Namibian authorities. They said, no, she's not in Namibia. So I think we can safely say she's also detained with Mr. Mugabe at their Harare home. It's called the Blue Roof.
And how is he able to move around the country, for instance, today going to the university?
What the military guys did was to disarm all the members of the forces that are loyal to Mr. Mugabe. So, of course, Mr. Mugabe is moving around, but under heavy military guard, they are controlling all his movements.
And where is the vice president? Where is he at this time?
Nobody really knows. I think I've heard reports that, well, he might be back in Zimbabwe. But the vice president alleges that he was poisoned. I don't think he's well. He might be trying to seek help outside the country because, you know, there were those reports. He said it himself that he was not feeling well. So it's possible that he might be in a hospital somewhere. And of course, one of his trusted allies, the chairperson of the War Veterans Association, Chris Muchangwa, was asked by reporters today about the whereabouts of Mr. Mnangagwa. He did not disclose his whereabouts, but there were reports that he was going to come. First, it was Wednesday, Thursday. Now it's Friday. But ever since he was ousted, nobody has seen him.
Well, thank you so much, Blessing, for keeping us up to date on all of these very interesting developments in Zimbabwe.
Thank you so much.
Well, foreign ministers from across Africa are in Washington today to discuss trade, security, and governance with U.S. officials. In addition, several officials were meeting on the sidelines with the AU's leadership to discuss urgent issues such as the political crisis in Zimbabwe. My colleague Vincent McCorry recently spoke about the Africa meeting with Donald Yamamoto, the acting Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. They discussed the United States' top priorities for the continent.
The focal point will be on three areas. It's going to be on economic development, trade, investment. Then the next part is on governance. And then third will be on counterterrorism and countering violent extremism. But I think one of the themes, besides deepening and expanding U.S.-Africa relations, is what is Africa going to look like in year 2100? And it's going to be the largest continent in the world. It's going to be 2.2 billion people. And the other issue, too, is what about the opportunities? Are we helping prepare Africa to meet not only the growing population, but also the needs, economic needs?
And, you know, if we just perhaps just focus a little bit on trade.
Right.
At the moment, people are saying China seems to have more presence on the continent. How is the U.S. leveraging itself on the continent at the moment as we speak?
I think if you look at the United States and our approach to not just Africa, but in other regions of the world, it's a much more multidimensional, very complex approach, because we focus on the whole approach. In other words, not just only humanitarian assistance, but also developing capacity, infrastructure, and also looking at capacity building. So in other words, looking at how we can have sustainable economic growth. One of the areas that concerns us, of course, is the re-indebtedness of some countries in Africa who, you know, we helped Africa get off debt through the HIPC process. And now we're finding countries who have gotten off of debt being re-indebted through borrowing money. And what we think is that economic development can happen without going back into debt, and we don't want Africa to go back into debt.
There have been talks that, in fact, there's a reduction in spending on, mm-hmm. on the military, and especially as far as the focus on Africa is concerned. So to what extent can you reassure, particularly those regions that are affected by terrorism, like in West Africa, North Africa, and even the East African region?
Yes, as you know, the United States has worked hand-in-hand with our African partners. We have, in the past 10 years, trained over 300,000 African troops. And as you know, in Africa, 63% of all UN operations are in Africa. 87% of all UN troops are in Africa, of which 70% are African troops. And the United States has been hand-in-hand trying to train, support, and sustain African efforts and forces to upgrade and guarantee their own security.
What you're saying is that the interest is not so much about pumping up a lot of money into, say, U.S. Engagement, but mm-hmm. to help those countries to take care of their own affairs.
That's right. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so even though budgets are always decreasing, but they're focused. And so right now, for instance, we look at Somalia, East Africa. We look at the G5 countries, you know, Mauritania, Niger, Chad, Mali, Burkina Faso. We look at the Lake Chad region and Nigeria. But then we look at other security challenges as well across the continent. Mm-hmm. And those countries, we are working hand-in-hand to not only upgrade their security elements, but also do coordination among these states so that they could resist a lot of the problems coming from the outside, like mm-hmm. Boko Haram, ISIL West, groups, drug trafficking, and other armed groups from the north.
That was Ambassador Donald Yamamoto speaking with VOA's Vincent McCorry in Washington. In Cameroon, an investigation is underway into the cause of an overnight fire that destroyed much of the country's parliament. Moki Edwin Kenzika reports from Yaoundé.
Thank you.
Hundreds of firefighters battled the late-night fire ravaging Cameroon's parliament building. Sulen Dundat is an official of the fire brigade.
We met the fourth floor completely consumed by the fire, so we concentrated ourselves on saving what could be saved.
By daybreak, four of the seven floors had been consumed by the blaze, though no one was harmed. Issa Chiruma, Cameroon government spokesperson, says an investigation has been opened, but that authorities do not suspect foul play.
The fire started accidentally. The National Assembly has been always under the protection and safeguard of very well-trained, committed and dedicated forces. Parliament, which started 2 days ago, will continue without being perturbed, without being disturbed.
The timing of the fire is raising some eyebrows. It happened less than 2 days after lawmakers from Cameroon's main opposition party, SDF, announced they would boycott this session of parliament. The 15 opposition MPs are demanding the government do more to resolve a year-long strike in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions. The strike was called to protest the dominance of the country's French-speaking majority and has escalated amid a government crackdown and the emergence of separatist groups demanding full independence. Arson attacks have been a hallmark of the unrest, with dozens of schools, business and public buildings torched in the Anglophone regions since January. No one has claimed responsibility. However, it is believed the locations that have been burned were targeted for failing to respect the calls to strike. The opposition SDF lawmakers, many of whom are from the Anglophone Northwest and the Southwest, say they have been threatened and even physically attacked at home for continuing to serve in the National Assembly. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Twenty-two minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. At least two people have died today in Nairobi as police and opposition supporters clashed in the streets. The police were trying to shut down a convoy of cars taking opposition leader Raila Odinga from the airport to a rally in the center of the city. Odinga had just returned from a trip abroad. Witnesses report the police used water cannons and tear gas against the crowds and in some areas fired guns. It is not clear how the deaths occurred. Odinga has been in the U.S. and Britain speaking about Kenya's political turmoil. The Supreme Court nullified the August presidential election, and Odinga boycotted a second vote held last month, saying the Election Commission had acted improperly. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta won the second vote. The Supreme Court is to rule Monday on court challenges to the election rerun. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says the South Sudanese government is engaged in a brutal, protracted military campaign against a fragmented opposition and says while both sides are responsible for atrocities against civilians, the government is primarily responsible for ethnically based killings. Nikki Haley, who made those remarks yesterday at Washington's Holocaust Museum, says nothing prepared her for the level of suffering she saw when she recently visited South Sudanese refugee camps. Haley traveled to South Sudan last month, becoming the first senior member of the Trump administration to do so. She said the United States at one point had high hopes for the country's leader, Salva Kiir, but there is now revulsion with what he has allowed to happen in the past few years. Six years after the death of dictator Muammar Gaddafi, political and military leaders in Libya have yet to bring about peace and stability. A new organization called Libya Pride says women can and should play a leading role in stabilizing the nation. Naira Abada is a consultant to the organization. She talked with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about its recent conference and the ideas it offers.
We have spent the last 6 months researching and meeting with different Libyan women in the south, west, and east of Libya, discussing what's missing to bring the peace and stability. We even spoke to women in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq to discuss the experience they had in the political arena. And we've concluded that there's a need for stabilization strategy on the subnational level rather than the national level, led by women in key positions, which will bring the sustainable peace, as we have seen small examples on the ground in Libya. So what's the first phase after hearing their experience was to hold a conference to open a dialogue, to start an open discussion with women that have experience in the political arena.
The conference attracted speakers from the Council of State, the Parliament, and Libyan Election Committee. Did their participation indicate some degree of unity and consensus on the role of women in reaching a political solution in Libya?
They agreed with the audience that, or the participants in the conference, that we need more women in the politics, or we need more women in key decision makers and policy makers. This is obviously the first time we have women in from the political arena discussing their struggles, their obstacles that they face, you know, in a conference. They agreed that we need more women, and they shared their honest experience.
So far, political and military leaders in Libya were not able to bring about peace and stability to Libya. What role could the Libyan women play to bridge that gap between the Libyan rivals?
A pivotal role. We need women to be more vocal and take a well-strategized movement in the political and military. If you want to see a serious change, women need to work on the subnational level reconciliation followed by the national. Because this is the only way to bring the rivals or East and West together.
What were the recommendations of your conference?
We have four recommendations. We launched a survey before the conference a while back online, an offline survey, and we've launched the survey after the conference to see how the participants, you know, saw the speakers and did it change their minds or did it put dots on the words. So we will publish the survey to share with locally on the media and online, which is the first step we thought we'll do. And then after the conference, we agreed to start a coalition between the NGOs to create a more forceful power and create a safe environment for women entering the politics arena. And the third one, it was to create positive campaign to change people's perception about Libyan women entering the politics, which is a huge issue that we have here, that people see that women should not be in politics or a military or the security field. And the fourth area, which is launching a second edition of the conference, but not in Tripoli. We were discussing either to launch it in Benghazi or in Sabha or in the mountains.
That was Naira Abada, a consultant to the Libya Pride organization. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.